It does seem like we're a 33 and a third record playing at 78, doesn't it? It seems like things are going really fast. It seems like we have lots of many different things coming upon us at the same time. You watch the news and you see those poor people in Hong Kong, and you know that unless God intervenes, there's not going to be a good ending for that for them. You think about those people who are deciding whether to board up their homes or make a run for it. Maybe they're too late to make a run for it. You think of those families in Odessa that in Midland that have their life will never be the same again. You think of our brothers and sisters over at Bront, and you think about their preacher's past and all of his family that's going through the certainty that's awaiting us. And the what do we do now? This morning we announced about Jackie Willis' sister. When the doctor tells you you have cancer in your bones, that's a pretty serious deal. Sister Linda Brown's son, Casey, has a perforated colon. And they're trying to decide whether he needs to have surgery or if the antibiotics will help it. So they're on a wait-and-see kind of a thing. And Evelyn Keith is trying to figure out what to do with the rest of her life and their family. We know a lot about what's going on in the world, and a lot of it we'd probably be happier if we didn't know. But the fact is, there we are. It's always been that way. Maybe not quite like it is now, but there's always times in history of great turmoil, great change. Even some of the things we would see as good change when we move from, say, an agricultural life to an industrial life, it's a good change, but it didn't mean there wasn't a lot of suffering. Because towns died and cities grew and people had to learn a whole new way of making a living. Many people are displaced. Now we're in a world-changing time of maybe it's a retreat back to socialism, or at the very least, it's a move from an industrial base to an information base, and lots of people are going to be left behind. People have had their life all planned out. It's quite a change. Lots of stress. There was a time like this at the end of the first century when Christ first appeared on the scene, and he gathered up that little band of disciples and he began to teach them, and then he died and rose from the dead, and a whole new world opened up. And it was a grand and glorious thing, wasn't it? It was also a time of great stress. Because darkness doesn't retreat easily. And eventually, when it was seen that they couldn't just ignore this new thing, those that were opposed to God's plan began to systematically attack it. The apostles were hunted down. The leaders in the church were imprisoned or put to death. Families were broken up. A property they had maybe spent generations gathering up was taken from them. Even their very life was taken from them. Peter tells us in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 13. He said, I think it's right, as long as I am in this body, to arouse you by way of reminder, since I know that the putting off of my body will be soon, as our Lord Jesus Christ showed me, and that I will see to it that after my departure, you may be able at any time to recall these things. Peter knows that he's going to die soon. And so he wrote, and many of the stories about Peter we remember from Scripture, the conversations with Jesus and Peter's own testimony. For example, he says in this same letter, the first letter to the church, he said that he knows that Jesus is God. He says, we're not following some cleverly devised myth. I was there on the mountain when he was transfigured. Peter's always fascinated me. Paul sort of frightens me. He has such a high standard of demand. He's got warts, doesn't he? And he's got some of the same kind of problems we have. And because of that, we kind of want to identify with him. We're going to do something a little different tonight. And that is that we're going to veer off of the reservation of the normal way that sermons are prepared, okay, are presented. A sermon, if it's any good, it's like the two rails of a train track. This sounds like a parable, doesn't it? On one track, you have human experience, our story, what we know. On the other track, you have the Word of God. Some sermons start off with the Word of God, usually mine do. And then we attempt to throw ropes over and hook on to our life. In other words, saying this applies to you in your life. If you don't have the application, you don't have a sermon. You have something else, but it's maybe a lesson or some sort of a textual study. But as far as the sermon is the taking the truth that we know that applies and putting it in the life that we live. In Jesus' day, many times he went the other direction. He would start with a guy sowing grain, or a fisherman pulling in a net, or a son that was not very respectful, or a king who was being defrauded of his property. And then he would throw the hook over and surprise everybody with reminding them that this fits with the will of God. Matter of fact, Mark tells us in chapter 4, he never preached without a parable. The parable was a truth, but it wasn't an exact detailed account of something that actually happened. It was like a good novel. It would be, this is the way people are, this is a truth that happens here. But in other words, there might not have been a boy that went away with his father's property and they had that conversation on the field. But we know it's true because we've seen very similar things happen, and we know that in a better way or a bigger way, it really happened with what God did with us. Y'all with me? All right, what we're going to do is if this was like in chapel at school, I tell them, all right, everybody put your imagination hats on. And amazingly enough, a lot of them do, you know. So put your imagination hat on, okay? Two of you did. Three of you did. That's good. That's good. All right. All right, we're going to look at this, and we're going to look at Peter. And we know a lot about him. We know about his call. We know about the conversations he had with Jesus, both good and bad as far as Peter was concerned. We know about his denial of Jesus. We know about his return to Jesus. We know about his preaching that day on Pentecost. We know a lot about him, don't we? We know how that he was still Peter, no matter how far into his life you got. And so we know that one time he still had some problems when he moved over and sat with the A team instead of with the Gentiles. We don't remember all of those things, and they're all true. They're the Word of God. You can count on it and everything. We have other things that we probably know from history, and that's that we're told, and the records that were made in the second century and the third century as they talked about it. Maybe they had access to information we didn't have. And in other words, they believed, or the report is, that Peter died in Rome as a martyr. He also was crucified, and the story goes that he was embarrassed to be crucified like his Lord was, and he begged his killers not to do that, kill me any other way. And so they, as a cruel joke, turned the cross upside down and crucified him head down. And, you know, now, how's that? You like that better? You know, that kind of stuff. You know, maybe that happened. Sounds like something the Romans would do, and that sounds like something Peter would say, doesn't it? I'm going to imagine tonight, and I'd like for you to join me, that Peter, it's the night before he's taken to be put to death. All appeals are over, all conversations are done, and he's waiting his execution. It's going to happen in the morning. Probably early before it gets too hot so the soldiers can go do whatever else they do. We're also going to imagine, if you will, that a clerk, maybe a junior officer, has been going around and making sure that everything is done right and that we have the right prisoner in the right cell and the right person will be executed in the right way so that everything will match up. Maybe he's even curious and he wants to talk to this prisoner who is well known. The Romans consider him a terrorist. The Jews consider him a blasphemer. But a lot of people side with him. A lot of people believe what he believes. Maybe this soldier even has relatives. Some are even in Caesar's house that have bought into this story of Jesus. So maybe he's curious as well, but we're going to have him come in and talk to Peter to make sure everything is right. And we're going to pretend that we're in the next cells around there with our ear to the door listening to the conversation. Okay? That's a stretch. Turn your little imagination knob up to high, all right? I have one thing that the soldier might say, and then the rest will be Peter. Are you Peter, the Christian terrorist? I am Peter. I'm not a terrorist, but I am a Christian. You want me to tell you my story? I have to tell you another story first. I have to tell you about Jesus because without him, I wouldn't be here, you wouldn't be here. I would be fishing someplace. He is the defining thing in my life. The first time I met him, my brother Andrew had heard him preach, and he took me to him. All the way there, I was thinking, this is a waste of time. But when we got there and Jesus turned and looked at me, he smiled. He put his hand out and I got a hold of his hand and I did what I like to do in those days. Since I was bigger and stronger than most people, I thought I'll just give him the old squeeze test. And I started squeezing his hand. But instead of pulling his hand back or something, he just smiled and squeezed back. And I'm telling you, that carpenter was strong. We stood there squeezing each other's hands, and I made some decisions. First of all, I decided I liked this guy. He's no wimp. You know, carpenters, they cut the tree down, they drag it home, sometimes on their own shoulder. They make boards out of it, and they build things with it. And you might not know, being a Roman who's never done a lick of work in his life, you may not know, but carpenters also worked with stones. They were builders. They weren't just woodworkers. They weren't furniture makers. They were the people that actually dug the ditch to put the foundation in, and so a carpenter would have calluses on his hands and muscles that bulged out, and he did. And I liked him for that. I liked the way his hand felt when he held. I had no idea I would be touching him as much as, or maybe I should say, him touching me as much as he did. Jesus just liked to touch people, and he liked to get right in your face. And when he touched you, he looked right in your eyes. And let me tell you about the way he looked when he looked at you. It was like he's hiding nothing. He's totally open. I've never seen anybody like that. And it was obvious he could see everything. I'm telling you, he could read your mind. Most of the time when he looked at me, I could tell he really liked me. He maybe loved me. One time, he grabbed a hold of my shoulders and he said, "Your heart is a rock. I think I'll name you Peter." And it stuck. Everybody called me that. I don't know what you'd call it in Rome. Someday they'll say Rocky instead. It wasn't always happiness. Sometimes when he got a hold of you and pointed you towards him and put his hands on you, he was reprimanding you. He had such a high standard. He wanted us to get it. So every day, all day, everything he saw, he pointed at it and he talked to us about it. It was like that passage that Moses said, when you walk by the way, when you sit down, when you get up, and it was like we were his children and he was always pointing. You couldn't see a shepherd putting sheep up or a fisherman folding his nets or anything. You couldn't see anything that he didn't say. Now, this is like the kingdom. Whether he was talking about a grain of wheat or whether he was talking about a mustard seed or whether he was talking about a rebellious son, it didn't matter. He kept pointing and talking and showing it all the time. And I loved it. Most of the time I was trying to catch up. You were always behind, a step or two behind. When you were behind and you shouldn't have been, he really laid it on you. But when you got, oh, he was so happy. One day he asked, "Who do men say that I am?" And we told him what all the reports were. Some people think you're Jeremiah, some Elijah, some one of the prophets. But then he said, "Well, who do you say?" And you don't know me, but I always want to be first. It's caused me so much trouble. But that day it really worked out. I said, "Well, you're the Christ, the Son of God." He put his hands on me, and he looked at me, and he smiled. He said, "Absolutely right. You got that from God," which was the best compliment he ever paid to me. And then he told us again, like he always did. He took us back to the kingdom and back to his teaching, and he said, "And that's what we're building. That's what I'm building my church on. That fact right there. Hold on to it." There were other times that he wasn't so pleased with my progress or digression. I remember one day he was talking about his crucifixion, and I tried to take over again, and I said, "This will never happen." He told me, Get out of the way, Peter. You're hurting the kingdom. You're working against the cause. Get back here." And when he looked at me that day, he wasn't happy. You know, he was God. He was God. John told us that we beheld his glory. Glory is the only Son of God. And I'm telling you, I was with John on that mountain when we saw him transfigured. I know who he is. I guess I knew it from right at the beginning. You see, I saw him do things that can't be done. One day we caught so many fish, it almost sunk the boat. At his word, where he told us to put the net. This carpenter could know nothing about that. And when we'd caught nothing, now we caught everything. You wouldn't have called it a confession, but it sort of was. I fell on my knees and I told him, "You stay away from me. I'm a sinful man. I can't be this close to God." But he wouldn't stay away. Every day he was talking to me, or looking at me, or sharing with me, or pointing me. And I saw him stop storms with a word. I saw dead people come back to life. I saw people that's arms and legs were all withered up that hadn't moved in years spring back to life. I saw him create hundreds of pounds of bread and fish just by saying a prayer. I saw him alive again when he was dead. And I saw him ascend into heaven. This is no made-up story. No one could make a story up like this. This is the real thing. I was there when I saw him transfigured. That's the best word we have for it. What I saw was God standing there. And what I heard was God the Father above me. And I'd already seen some marvelous thing. I'd already met Moses and Elijah. But there's nothing like Jesus. That's why what I did was such a shame. He started talking more and more. I told you about when I tried to stop him from finishing his task. But he wouldn't quit talking about it. He kept telling us more and more about how he wouldn't be with us much longer and for us not to be afraid. And he kept telling us this and that and everything. And finally one day he's talking about what's going to happen to him. And I said, "This will not happen." He then told us that we would all let him down. I don't know about those other guys, but I knew about me, I thought. I put my hand on my robe to make sure my sword was still under there. I said, "Not while I'm around. Happen over my dead body." And then he got a hold of me again, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, "You won't make it through tonight. Before the rooster crows in the morning, you will have denied me and denied me and denied me." I was so hurt. I was so angry with him. "Now, maybe sometime I'll let you down, but you don't think I can make it one night? You think that I can't do that?" He said that Satan's going to take you and sift you. I'm praying for you. I didn't hear any of that. I was just upset. I set my jaw, clenched my fist, and was determined to show him. We go to the garden, and he starts praying, and he asked me to do one thing, not guard his life, which I was prepared to do, but he asked me to pray. Instead, I slept. I didn't mean to, but I did. He looked at me again. Said, "You can't even pray for an hour?" I was so ashamed. And then they came. A whole mob of them. The traitor was with them. I planted myself between Jesus and them, drew my sword, and went to work. I didn't kill anybody, but I got a guy's ear. Jesus stopped it all. Put the ear back on. And nobody, you'd think everybody would start praising him and worshiping him, but no, they just kept on with the deal. And Jesus told me to put my sword up. I was hurt, disillusioned. If I can't do this, what can I do? They took him away, pulling on his beard, kicking him, dragging him. They had him, had God's son tied up there, and I'm standing there. You know, we all ran off. John and I followed, but I stayed a good safe distance away. When we got to the place where the trials, if you could call them trials, it was a setup deal from the beginning. There wasn't a believer in the group at the Sanhedrin. Half of the seats were empty, and it was obvious that it was a controlled event. They had people lying about everything, and they were writing it all down as if it was a very important meeting. And all the time, they're abusing him, slapping him, kicking him, sending him back and forth to Herod and to Pilate. And during all of that time, I'm there, but I'm not. And people started asking, you know, the bad thing about being as big as I am, and us from Galilee, we talk different than the people down in Jerusalem talk, and it was, they had noticed me before, me and my big mouth. I was always at the front of the line. And one by one, they would ask me. One by one. And I would say, I don't know him. You got the wrong guy. I'm standing by a charcoal fire one night, and I'm standing there by that fire and warming myself, and they say, you're one too, aren't you? You're one of his men. And I said, I wasn't. And one time I was even afraid of a little girl, a servant who had no power at all. Before it was over with, I was swearing and claiming I didn't know the man. It was at that exact moment two things happened. One is a rooster crowed. And the other, Jesus turned and looked at me. It was obvious he loved me. It was obvious he was hurt. And there I was. I don't usually cry, or didn't then. But I went out and cried and cried and cried while they finished this awful thing they did to him. Later, after he was buried, we reassembled. But it wasn't like usual. We crept in, afraid of our own self. I thought the other men wouldn't have anything to do with me, but they had all done something similar. Not as bad as me, but they had all done something similar. The only one that wasn't there was Judas. And then, it's Sunday morning, I remember. Some women had gone to the tomb, and they found it empty. And they talked to angels. And they came back and told us. And it was, you would think if you'd seen a man walk on the water, oh, that's another story. You know, I walked on the water a little ways. And then my faith gave out, and I sunk. I prayed, Jesus saved me, Lord saved me, and he did. But that look wasn't a good one. He said, you got to have faith, man. You got to have this. He did that every time. Anytime he saw any faith being demonstrated, he pointed it out. And I should have got it, but I didn't. But they said the angels told them he was alive, that it was inappropriate for a live man to be in a dead man's tomb. And They told us to come tell y'all. An angel told me to tell you. I couldn't believe it. Are you sure? He said, Peter. He said, yes. It all happened pretty quick after that, one by one, different people. John and I ran down there, and we found it just like the women said. You know how competitive I am. John's younger, but I outran him. But I wouldn't go in the tomb. That's that faith problem, you know. John ran right in there. And he came out believing. He said, look at these clothes. Look how they are. No one undressed him. No one rolled. It was just before that day is over. Jesus has already met with several people. Some guys that were on the way to Emmaus come running in telling us they had seen the Lord. And we told them about all that we had done. And then he appeared. And he went around touching us, and looking at us, and breathing on us. One day, not very long after that, we were trying to get back into our life. We went fishing. And if you don't think parables work, if you don't think there's not connections between things, that day was a strange day. We didn't catch anything. We fished all night. Maybe we thought we were never going to get back into this fishing business. We've forgotten how. But you know what was nagging my mind all the time was another time we'd caught no fish. And then a man on the beach yelled at us and told us to put our nets on the other side of the boat. I'm telling you, the hair on my arm stood up. But we did it. And we caught them. We caught all those fish. Somebody said, it's the Lord. I dove in the water and swam to shore. When they got there, I drug the net in. And there he is. Did he have to build the fire out of charcoal? Like, you know what I'm thinking. Before that event's over with, he not only has identified himself again to us and everything, but he's got me aside, and we go back and forth as he is talking to me, giving me this great opportunity to connect. He put his hands on my shoulders. He looked me right in the face, and he said, do you love me? I told him I loved him, but I didn't use the right word. It was kind of a, you're my best friend kind of statement. He asked me again and again, and then he did something that was so typical of Jesus. He gave me a job. He said, feed my sheep. And then, like God did with Abraham, when he entered the covenant with him, he pulls me into history with him, and he tells me the future. He tells me that there will be a day when someone's going to chain me up and take me where I don't want to go and do things to me I don't want to happen to me. Does that sound kind of familiar? But do you know what I heard? What I heard was, Peter, you're going to make it. When your whole life is over, whether it's short or long, you're still going to be faithful. Satan has sifted you. I have prayed for you, and you're going to make it. And I have. Now, the other guys, they didn't understand what he was telling me, but I knew exactly what he was telling me. So beat me, bloody, chop my head off, do whatever you want to do with me. I must speak the things I've seen and heard. You decide what I should do, but I must obey God rather than men. A rooster. We've been talking all night, haven't we? Do you know every day I wake up to that? There's nowhere I've been that there's not roosters crowing. Every morning I hear a rooster crow, and my first thought every day, I don't know him. But do you know what my second thought is? Not today. I'm sure you've got something to do. The guards came by earlier and they told me they had noticed that I had asked them not to crucify me. And they said, "Don't worry, we have something special planned for you." And the way they laughed, I assumed that it's not going to be pleasant. But don't worry about me. I'm going home. Don't worry about me at all. Today, in this place, I'm the only free man here. Everything is going to be all right with me. Because everything I've told you is absolutely the truth. Do you believe this man named Peter? Do you believe that Jesus picked him out of the crowd and made him an apostle, gave him big work to do? Do you believe that he was inspired by God? Peter preached the first gospel sermon, and his words are in almost every gospel sermon. It's all about faith. Faith that's strong enough to get you to obey him. I promise you, Satan wants to sift you as well. Don't fail this test. If you need to come to God, this is the time. Won't you come while we stand and sing?